Well, hello again all. Our time has come. Welcome to the teleclass, Safe Childbirth, What Can Infection Prevention Contribute? My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of Dr. Syed Sattar and the rest of the teleclass organizing group, thank you very much for joining us today. Now, I think it's safe to say that Pat Lynch has been there. President of APIC, she's been there. President of the International Federation of Infection Control during four of the most progressive years in that organization's history, she's been there. An architect of modern infection prevention and control since 1968, she's been there. Infection control consultant to facilities and governments in approximately 35 countries around the globe, strong advocate for improved infection control practices in developing nations, lead author of Infection Prevention with Limited Resources, a handbook for infection control committees, one of the most organized, capable, and kind people that I've ever met. Pat's been there, and she is there. She has also been a member of our teleclass faculty. In fact, the recording of her 2004 teleclass lecture on global infection control is actually still by far the most accessed in our recordings library, with something close to 250,000 hits. It is a distinct honor for me to be able to introduce this marvelous lady once again. So to present the teleclass, Safe Childbirth, What Can Infection Prevention Contribute? I am pleased to present the chair of IFIC Safe Childbirth Special Interest Group, Patricia Lynch. Pat.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to talk with all of you today because safe childbirth has not been an infection prevention issue, and I've been with infection prevention practically since the beginning, so I know that for sure. And thanks to all of you for your interest in participating. I'm going to assume that everyone who is listening in has an interest in safe childbirth issues, that is, reducing neonatal and maternal mortality, and also in infection control. Paul asked me for objectives, of course, before I began this, and I'm going to spend most of the time reviewing the scope of the problem of neonatal and maternal mortality because it's not well known in infection prevention and it's not occupied a space in the literature. By the end of the talk, I'd like everyone to be able to recognize that although the scope of the problem of neonatal and maternal mortality is global, women and babies in poverty in any country in the world, are more likely to have fatal complications of childbirth than their more affluent mothers. Become aware of how neonatal and maternal mortality manifests in our own countries and within certain settings within that country, and appreciate how significantly healthcare-associated infections make a bad problem worse. Then in the last, after we've talked about the scope and the magnitude of the problem, I'd like to develop some ideas about what strategies might effectively reduce risk for both babies and mothers. In addition to those objectives, I want to be sure and mention that IFIC and the company Covidian are co-sponsoring a competition for proposals to improve safe childbirth, particularly with an eye toward infection prevention. And you can go to www.theific.org, www.theific.org, and the proposal competition will pop up as part of the home page. And last of all, the special interest group was formed last year, example, Few Americans, so I would really like to increase the number of people who are willing to work with the special interest, example, Few Americans, so I would really like to increase the number of people who are willing to work with the special interest group, particularly if you have time and you're an experienced volunteer. In other words, I'd really like somebody to join me. So now let's talk about safe childbirth. What can infection prevention contribute? The sorry truth is that about 4 million neonates die as a result of childbirth every year. And about 500,000 women die of childbirth complications immediately. But millions more are disabled by complications of childbirth, and these include a number of things that I'll go into. Next slide. The what on neonatal deaths is 38% of mortality in kids under the age of 5 occurs in the first 28 days of life, and this is what's called the neonatal period. These are estimates developed by Zupan and colleagues with the World Health Organization and are available from a number of WHO publications. Neonatal mortality rates, or NMRs, can be in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 per 1,000 live births, compared to 3 to 5 in more affluent settings. And neonatal infection rates range 3 to 20 times higher than hospital-born babies in more affluent facilities, a shocking difference. Next slide. So deaths within the first 28 days, 25 to 50% of neonatal deaths occur within 24 hours of birth. Now, these include complications of birth such as asphyxia, birth traumas, hemorrhage, and those kinds of things. Infection doesn't play a major role until a little later. Neonatal deaths account for 24 to 56% of deaths in children under the age of 5 all across the whole 6 WHO regions. So a huge proportion of deaths in infants. Part of the reason for that, the reason that that fraction is so high, is that the world has had quite a bit of really good success in reducing mortality of youngsters, toddlers particularly, kids up to the age of 5, with immunizations, vitamin A supplements, and other strategies that are appropriate for them. Neonatal deaths, those in the first 28 days, though, have been stuck on bad news for a long time and are not changing. The reference that I gave you on this is from one of Joy Lawn's extraordinarily excellent articles in a series that's been published in Lancet in the year 2005. It's available in Lancet online. You can get it by going there. There are four articles in the series, and I'll refer to them and to two others that have come out of a different Lancet subgroup several times. If you have no time to read up on this and you need to have solid data for a presentation, go to these references. So where is it that these babies die? 99% in low to middle income countries, but there's great variation within countries, and I'll show you that. There's a problem with this, and that is that there's poor registration of births and deaths in general, and neonates in particular. Less than 3% of the deaths are in countries with accurate statistics, so that makes the Zupan WHO estimates very important. About 60% of the deaths occur in 10 countries, and most occur outside hospitals, and that's because hospital care doesn't play a major role in many countries for delivering women. Finding that 60% of the deaths occur in 10 countries, I found to be kind of helpful, because as someone who works using tools of epidemiology all the time, when I see clustering like that, it's comforting to know that there are locales, positions, locations, where the risk is much greater and that you don't need to dissipate your efforts over many, many, many places, that you can concentrate on a relative few. Next slide. So these 10 countries with the highest NMRs per 1,000 live births are here. And let me just chat on about this a little bit. First of all, the country of India, which is second in population rank, provides 27% of the global neonatal mortality. Their neonatal mortality rate is high, but certainly not the highest, at 43 per 1,000 live births. The reason is the huge population, and the same thing is true in China. With the population rank of 1, the percentage of global neonatal mortality of 10%, that is 10% of neonatal mortality occurs in the country of China. But their actual neonatal mortality rate is relatively low. It's 21. There are many countries with much higher rates than this. Again, it's because of the huge population. If you look next at the country of Pakistan, the sixth largest country by population in the world, you see that it contributes 7% of neonatal mortality, but the rates are extraordinary, 57 per 1,000 live births. And you can just look down the line here at these countries and see what the contribution is. And as you read, you can look and see, gosh, it would be hard to provide better care there. Look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, for instance. Population rank is fairly low, number 18, but their neonatal mortality rate is 47 per 1,000 live births. Many of these countries have been embroiled in civil unrest and civil disturbance and actual wars in various locations for many years. So it's hard to see exactly how improvements would be made in some of these places. But they would be like all of the other improvements that we see, a little bit happening locally and growing from there. Next slide. This one shows in color the variation in neonatal mortality rates between countries. Now, I'm emphasizing again that it's comforting to see that there are some countries where high rates are quite concentrated, and you can imagine how you could work there. The Western African countries, for instance, Nigeria, places surrounding Nigeria, over on the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Somalia. Then looking up India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, up that red corridor that leads up toward Russia, you see that rates are very high. But within countries, you also find great variation among rates. You see that Mexico is somewhat higher than U.S. and Canada, and that Latin America, Central America, and also South America have many areas where they have relatively low rates. This is really good news. Now, the indirect cause of neonatal deaths is poverty. That's clear, essentially, in every location. But there's relative poverty within a country. The disparity in neonatal mortality rates between the top and the bottom 20% in Canada was assessed in a lovely publication by Z.C. Luo a couple of years ago. But it probably occurs in all countries. This is a really nice study if you need a piece of supporting information to say that within affluent countries such as the U.S. and Canada, that there is great disparity between the top most affluent people in terms of neonatal mortality rate and the bottom least affluent people. It occurs in all countries, and it certainly occurs in the U.S. and Canada. The magnitude of understanding that is clear in the next part of the slide. If the 20 African and three South Asian countries with the high rates were to equalize the top and the bottom quintile, global rates would be reduced by 19%. Now, here is a nice example of the variation within a particular country. This is the country of South Africa, right down there on the tip of the African continent. And the states within South Africa had a major conference on neonatal mortality several years ago, and I got this handout from them. So you see down in the lower left, Western Cape, which is the most affluent part of the country, where Cape Town, Mossel Bay, the wine country, relatively low rates. If you look over toward Eastern Cape, you see the rates are way high above that. If you look at Northern Cape, much, much higher. Now look over toward Mpumalanga State, it's on the mid-upper right, and you see that their neonatal mortality rate is 31 per 1,000 live births. And within 8 or so years ago, those rates were almost double that, almost double. So they have very swiftly brought down their neonatal mortality rates in that province. so it can be done. And on the next slide, we see some of the direct causes of neonatal mortality. In the very high NMR settings, more than 50% of the babies die of severe infection, tetanus, and diarrhea. When the NMR is under 15, that is a relatively low rate, sepsis and pneumonia are much more common, and diarrhea and tetanus are non-existent. In high NMR settings, the risk of death due to infection is 11 times greater. Late neonatal deaths are mainly due to infection, often acquired during delivery. So this is the segment in which we can have, as infection control people, we can have the most influence. Direct causes of neonatal mortality, in summary again, next slide, low birth weight, asphyxia, infection, maternal health, and interpartum complications, and wrap all up with inadequate prenatal health care. On the next slide, we move on to another topic. This is a piece of information that will amaze you, I'm sure. I was totally stunned by this, so let's just read through it for a minute. By the way, the reference on this is Karina Ronsman's and Wendy Graham. If you find articles by these two or either of them single, it most likely relates to this subject of maternal complications. Terrific work by these two. And this article is one, if you're interested in this field, to keep in your portfolio because it's got a wonderful review article. So the risk of a woman dying as a result of pregnancy or childbirth during her lifetime is about 1 in 6 in the poorest parts of the world, compared with about 1 in 30,000 in the Scandinavian countries. Now, that really makes you take a deep breath and think about the disparity. Dr. William Fagy, who was the head of the CDC a number of years ago, maybe in the early to mid-1980s, and is now the head of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, said that the disparity between affluent and non-affluent in maternal child complications is the barometer for quality of health care for a country. And when you look at this figure, you can see it's very true. Next slide. For maternal mortality in South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, about two-thirds of women deliver without a skilled attendant. That is, they have a family member present, but no one who really has training in the sense of skills. They may be experienced at delivering babies, but not with training. And the rates for no prenatal care, 30% overall, 46% in South Asia, and 34% in sub-Saharan Africa. Next slide shows you the maternal mortality ratios, comparable to the other slide that I showed you about neonatal mortality. And the denominator for maternal mortality is different. It's 100,000 rather than 1,000 for the babies. If you look at this, first focus on the blues, Australia, Northern and Western Europe, Canada. You see the distribution of the very low rates is actually quite small. Not a huge population and not a huge landmass either. Green is much more common. That would be the U.S., most of the countries in Latin America, all of the former Soviet Union, and the Eastern Mediterranean region, that is Northern Africa and circling around. When you get to the bright red countries, where you see maternal mortality over 1,000 per 100,000, you're dealing with very small landmass again, very comparable to the extreme blue, the extremely good ones. Next slide. The direct causes of maternal mortality, obstructed labor, malpresentation, hemorrhage, anemia, hypertension disorders. Three conditions alone, next slide, are responsible for a very disproportionate number of the deaths. tetanus, often acquired during delivery, anemia from malaria or malnutrition, and HIV transmission from an infected mother to an infant in sub-Saharan Africa is estimated at over 50%. Now, these conditions are all quite preventable. Even the HIV transmission can be prevented by prophylactic, low-cost medications. So we're looking at a huge proportion of the problem that is fixable with technology which now exists. It's a matter of getting it to people who actually need it. Next slide. The Global Plan for Improvement. I'm sure that you're all familiar with the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, which were developed by in the year 2000 as part of the Global Burden of Disease Project through WHO. These 8 goals were signed on to by almost all countries in the world. In other words, the president or the minister of health or whoever was appropriate signed off on these. And here are 3 that are not doing very well in the area that I'm talking about, which is immediately surrounding childbirth. So MDG 4, the international community committed itself to decrease the mortality ratio in children under the age of 5 by 65% before 2015. And as I mentioned earlier, the older children, those beyond the neonatal stage, have had just extraordinarily good responses to improved immunization, vitamin A supplementation, hand hygiene, diarrhea control measures, water improvements, things like that. In some countries, the difference has been just absolutely huge. But there's not an improvement in neonatal mortality at this point. It's hanging right where it was when we started. And the same thing essentially is true with MDG 5, really stuck on maternal mortality. MDG 6, this is a complicated one, and it says halt or begin to reverse the spread of HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases. Now, HIV is often transmitted via healthcare or from a mother to an infant, either by nursing or through the delivery process. So how much of this is really in our territory? Well, in very poor countries, healthcare is often delivered by relatively untrained people who use the same tools and equipment on everybody, and this includes the use of syringes. Hospitals in many places reuse plastic syringes without adequate sterilization between customers, and the effect in some places is huge. In the year 2000 Global Burden of Disease Project, there was an estimate made that a huge proportion, over 10% of HIV in developing countries, especially in the very poor countries, is transmitted through healthcare. Another interesting thing that came out of that study is that people in poor countries receive many more injections than people in affluent countries. And so there are many examples of this that are related to disease. One example, several years ago, I was contacted by an organization that was seeking to do training in Kazakhstan because they had had a large outbreak of HIV in young children, in neonates, whose parents were discordant. In other words, the baby was positive for HIV, and the parents were not HIV positive. So clearly the baby acquired it in some way other than the usual. And what they found was that the blood was not being adequately screened for HIV. But more interesting to me was the fact that they give small doses of blood, small blood transfusions, very frequently to infants for a variety of things, such as pneumonia or little babies who fail to pink up properly after delivery. And this was the thing that influenced me more than anything. I can understand a poor country not being able to screen blood adequately, but then it would be a good idea to not be transfusing quite so much. So all 3 of these Millennium Development Goals relate to the subject that I'm talking about. All of them are important. You couldn't actually choose between them. All need to improve simultaneously. Next slide. Here's an example of how things could improve. I know Sri Lanka has been in the news a lot lately because of the civil war that's gone on for such a long time, but they're also one of the best examples of core effectiveness at addressing the issue of maternal and neonatal mortality and complications. It's a small country, only 20 million. The GDP per person is about $3,500. Healthcare makes up a little under 2% of the country budget, and 6% of the population earns less than a dollar a day. Their 1950 neonatal mortality rate was 50 per 1,000 live births, and they lowered it to below 20 in 1980 and still dropping. So how did they do this? Here's how they didn't do it. They didn't add neonatal ICUs to their hospitals, and they didn't add extensive hospital care. What they did do was emphasize primary care with midwives posted to the rural areas and advisory people in hospitals, clinics, and available for home. So they've got 2,500 trained midwives in the year 2000 and a referral pathway for hospital care. So this is where we start as infection control people usually attached to a hospital. Here's where we start getting into it. Some more data. This is from Victor Rosenthal. The International Nosocomial Infection Control Consortium provided this data for a chapter that we wrote in hospital infections. 3 to 6 times higher in the INEC ICUs than the benchmark hospitals. The benchmark was the NHSN reporting system in the U.S. The participating hospitals, though, are university-affiliated and have good surveillance programs, or they couldn't participate in Dr. Rosenthal's INEC network. So they're not typical of hospitals in developing programs. He has maybe 15 or so countries represented now, more than 80 hospitals participating. So it's pretty solid data. And although the use of devices is not much higher or lower in the INEC hospitals than in the comparison hospitals, the infection rates are much higher. And here's an example, next slide, of device-associated infection rates in the NICUs, the neonatal ICUs of INEC. The central line-associated bloodstream infection rate of 12.4, essentially, per 1,000 central line days is much higher than the 4.4 rate for neonatal ICUs reported by DNHSN. This reference is from American Journal of Infection Control in fall of 2008, and it was published at the same time as the NHSN rates, so you can look for comparisons easily by accessing that particular issue. Next slide. So what about low-income countries or populations? Because it's clear from what we've seen so far that it's in some cases a whole country issue, but more commonly it's that bottom 20% in all countries that needs to be addressed. So capacity has to be added, and it needs to be the kind of capacity that Sri Lanka used. Sri Lanka is not alone in this, by the way. I found a number of country studies that reported huge decreases in maternal and neonatal mortality. Some places may need donor funding. It works best, you get the best reductions, when it's linked to existing facilities, resources, and services working together. And to me, that means that the hospitals and the infection prevention people within the hospitals need to be working more with the outpatient feeder systems and receiving systems. In other words, care is kind of a continuous loop between outpatient and inpatient. Pregnant women get cared for to some extent in outpatient. Sometimes they have their babies in an inpatient setting, and then they go back to the outpatient setting. And there needs to be more attention to infection prevention all the way down the line. Next slide. Now, I want to caution you not to take this next slide as discouraging. It's a good study, or I wouldn't have put it in here. This is by Goodburn. Trained traditional birth attendants were significantly more likely to practice hygienic delivery than untrained birth attendants. But no significant difference in postpartum infection was found when deliveries by trained and untrained TBAs were compared. So that tells us that the thing that we as infection control people often do first, which is provide education and training, will not work alone. It will have to be combined because the problem is too complex to be solved with in-service education or training. So the next slide may emphasize again this series from Lancet in 2005. The first reference provides background, which I have already shared quite a bit of with you. The second describes evidence-based, cost-effective interventions. And if you're looking to make improvements within your community, this is a good one to look at. Globally, the next author looks at systematic scaling up of neonatal care around the world. And then the fourth one describes ways that we can, that all policy people, countries, ministries of health, local health districts, hospitals need to work together. Good reading in all of them. Next slide. That third one, the scaling up, recommended implementation of universal packages for community care, prenatal, and postnatal period. They estimated the cost at that time in 2005, and I really don't know where the cost of money is right now. Things have changed. At about $2,100 per life saved. Now, life saved is a nice, hard, solid measure, but many problems can be improved without actually saving the life. So there are great benefits for reduced HIV, improved health, and a much better global public health system, which needs some improvement, frankly. Next slide. So how does all of this relate to infection prevention? Well, about a third of the neonatal deaths are related to infections. Many of the infections are acquired during delivery. Hospital infections play a major role. Excuse me. Hospital infections play a major role. Now, let me chat on about this for a minute, this number three here, as soon as I get a sip of water. If hospital infections play a major role, why don't we all know about this? What I found in the literature review was that there was not one single reference in infection control literature about this problem. I did a huge literature review with help from colleagues and support from several sources. And this is just not appearing in the infection prevention literature. So this is something that we have not addressed in the past, and it hasn't really been a big part of our job descriptions, and it hasn't been a big part of anybody else's job description either. So the fact that hospital infections play a major role has not galvanized people into action. The infection prevention societies aren't involved. When I went looking on websites for the infection prevention societies, I didn't find any that had any sort of homepage maternal neonatal infection prevention on there. Now, number five is kind of a sad thing. I've reviewed a lot of training manuals for small organizations in poor countries, particularly African countries, and a lot of the training literature doesn't have any sound infection prevention content in it. In other words, the people who are being taught to deliver babies using these tools, these learning tools, are not having their material reviewed by an infection prevention person who knows something about managing sterile supplies, managing supplies and equipment, handling, delivering patients. In fact, at IFIC, one of the things that the organization does every year is an abstract competition for scholarships to attend the conference. And often, the people who receive scholarship awards are reporting some phenomenal improvement in neonatal or maternal mortality or infection rates as a result of applying infection prevention principles. So it's important but not covered. It's a major public health issue, number six. I mean, this is huge. And the poverty gap in neonatal mortality rates affects all countries in the world. In other words, that nice study by the Canadian researcher, Luo, the poverty gap probably that was apparent in the Canadian study affects all countries. The bottom 20% of people have much higher mortality rates. And improvement is likely to be better if infection control is involved. So I think all of these are sound reasons that our infection prevention societies, local chapters, and hospitals themselves should be more aggressive in developing good strategies for this problem. Next slide. So where is infection prevention on the issue? Not very far. No articles, commentary, or editorials in infection control journals. No infection control societies with it on their websites. This is really important. No major initiatives with partners such as UNICEF, Bill and Melinda Gates, or Save the Children. There's a huge amount of money and effort being directed toward child health. But I have not been able to find one major project that has focus on infection prevention, either in the community or in the hospital, or better yet, the two of them working together. Most of the infection prevention societies have provided some support to the WHO hand hygiene and safe surgery, safe injections, and so on, but they haven't actually pushed for safe childbirth. And WHO, in fact, does not have an initiative for safe childbirth that is specifically related to infection prevention. Next slide. I'll chat about this a little bit, but you'll probably be wanting to look down it. In 1999, there were in the neighborhood of 190 countries. There's been some consolidation and some expansion in some areas. In other words, some new countries have been created. Some existing countries have been merged into other countries. But this gives national infant mortality rates. This is not the same as neonatal mortality rates, which is the first 28 days only. But you sort of see clearly from this is just the top tier, that some countries have considerably more emphasis on maternal child safety than others. If you look at, Hong Kong, Japan is the next country. Japan reduced its neonatal and maternal mortality rates after World War II within 10 years by a factor of about 50%. Phenomenal effectiveness. And everyone in Japan and in Hong Kong has access to health care now. So this is an important issue. I showed this slide at the APIC conference and asked if people felt that this represented this failure to deliver adequate health care to women and infants represented a human rights problem. And probably there might have been one or two people in the audience who didn't feel like it did, but most did. They felt that countries were not doing their best job at dealing with this issue, and that it shows on this graph. And if you had the other 100 and some odd countries tacked on that I didn't have room for on the slide, you'd see it very clearly. So to look at the difference, say, between the U.S., which is on the bottom line, and Cuba, just above it, a poor country, but generally kind of homogeneously poor, that is, everybody is about at the same level. You see part of the problem that's apparent in the U.S., probably in Canada too. Very affluent people get very good care. People who live in poverty, especially extreme poverty, don't get very good care. And the places that we find those people, immigrant populations in Canada and the U.S., native populations, those are places where the trouble lies. Next slide. This is what it looks like in my own state of Washington in the U.S. The low-income mothers, measured by women who receive Medicaid assistance and also temporary assistance to needy families, have a neonatal mortality rate of 9.1 per 1,000 live births. And you remember from the previous slide, that's very high. If they're moderately low income, that is, they receive Medicaid but not temporary assistance, the neonatal mortality rate is 6.3. And if they're higher income, that is, no Medicaid and no TANF, the rate is less than half of the low income mothers. I have some other comparisons here in the next slide. This is neonatal mortality rates in the state of Maryland, where the statewide rate is 8.1 per 1,000 live births, but in the big city, 11.3 per 1,000 live births. But African-American NMR is three times that for whites. I put Wisconsin on here because Wisconsin has, as part of the state health plan, a goal of eliminating health disparities. Remember, I mentioned the difference between the top quintile and the bottom quintile? This is what Wisconsin is up to. They're trying to eliminate that huge health disparity between the top of the income stream and the bottom in terms of maternal and neonatal mortality rate. Next slide. If you're from the U.S. or you want to explore this, you can get this easily by Googling neonatal mortality USA. You can get Child Health USA statistics, and I did that for the APIC conference for every state in the union. And the next slide. So this is a big problem. Who pays for it? First of all, society pays for it. We don't get these people. They die. Taxpayer-funded programs pay for it. We keep contributing money into a healthcare system that's supported by taxes, and it's not rescuing these people. The next generation pays for it because people aren't there, and they might turn have been the people that were really needed. But who really pays for it is the hospitals. So if you're looking for how to sell this to your hospital, the cost of care of preterm births, preemies, in ER visits, emergency obstetric care, huge. This is where hospitals eat the cost. Next slide. So how many are we talking about? In 2001, 7.7% of live births in the U.S., babies weighed less than 2,500 grams at birth, and that's an increase from the year 2000, despite improvements in the use of prenatal care. That is, it's still an access problem. The people who need the care aren't getting it. The percentage of newborns born at low birth weight has risen steadily over the last 30 years. Next slide. And how does this relate to infection prevention in the U.S.? Well, it really doesn't. It hasn't in the past. It was in all of my previous years of working in the field of hospital infections, this never came up. I mean, I have to say not rarely, never. But it could. And why is that? It's because inadequate federal, state, and local funding means that the hospitals have an opportunity to improve care and decrease costs. And the aspect of decreasing costs is important. Next slide has an example of a program that I picked up. There aren't very many, by the way, in the U.S. that I could find. This is at the Banner Hospitals. It's a hospital chain in Arizona. And the one that I visited had a prenatal program that was initiated by the hospital. Their local crisis pregnancy center had been closed because of inadequate federal funding. And the nurses, delivery room nurses and labor room nurses in the hospital, felt that this was just intolerable. They were getting mostly kids in to deliver who had not had any prenatal care, and they just felt that it was just intolerable. So they developed a program, next slide, so that potential clients can self-refer for a pregnancy test. The labor and delivery nurses provide and interpret the test and a kit of information. If the patient has no doctor, the labor and delivery nurse will review the MDs who participate in the program, who will accept new patients before funding is approved, and they go with them to the office of the patient's choice. And the hospital supports this. The office staff greet the person, make an appointment, and develop with them the application for funding. So that's what these kids need. Next slide. The prenatal support program, the people that I interviewed said there were fewer surprises in the delivery room. In other words, young mothers showing up at the last minute already in labor with a baby in trouble. Fewer come to the ER in labor with no prenatal care. And the benefit to the hospital is that some of those clients choose to deliver at Banner, and they either get federal reimbursement or reimbursement in some sort of system. When I went to Hong Kong last summer to talk at the wonderful Hong Kong ICNA conference, I was talking about safe childbirth as one of the presentations, and the very first person who came to the microphone was a young ER doctor, and he said, what are we going to do? Young women in China catch the train across, show up in our emergency rooms with no prenatal care. And I said, yes, yes, that is exactly what happens. You have to reach out to them before they come in the hospital door. So the next slide, how can you promote safe childbirth in your own facility? First of all, you have to get it on your schedule to do. I mean, make a commitment to do something about this. You can assess safe childbirth. That is how to reduce mothers who come in already with infection from premature rupture of membranes and inadequate care. And then reduce NICU device-related infections. I mentioned that American Journal of Infection Control issue that has Dr. Rosenthal's INIC data and the U.S. NHSN data together. If you look closely, you'll notice that the NICU device-associated infection rates are higher than other ICUs, and so there is room to improve NICU device-related infections, primarily ventilator-associated pneumonias and central line-associated bloodstream infections. You can use the opportunity to develop facility awareness and increase public and government consciousness. The infection rates and mortality rates of the poorest people in your communities are stunningly different from the average. What can the infection prevention societies contribute locally? IFIC has 65 member societies, several observer societies from 55 countries. So 3/4 of the countries of the world still don't have their own national infection control society. And if you are from one of those countries, it would be a good idea to begin to work, begin the slow process of developing an infection prevention society within your own country or region, and then be able to work with them. Then work with existing health organizations to bring that lowest quintile up, so that it matches the average for neonatal and maternal mortality rate, and make that a goal. You really need to have other healthcare professional associations involved. I've had lots of contact with midwifery organizations. They've been tremendously responsive and willing to work with infection control people and with anyone else to improve prenatal care and postnatal care of babies. And then amplify that existing action with a lot of buzz, a lot of chat. Try to get it into your hospital newsletter. Try to get it on the schedule for your speakers who come to your local infection control groups. Try to get a really good fix on the scope and magnitude of the problem right in your very own area where you can have direct influence on it. And the next slide, the National Infection Prevention Contribution. In many, if not most countries, the National Infection Control Society is very important in pushing policy. For example, look at the U.S. How would U.S. hospital infection policy even take place without APIC? In Canada, how would policy changes be suggested or implemented if it were not for CHICA? How would that link between hospitals and community even happen if it weren't for the society? So the role of the national IC societies is very important in pushing policy change, in suggesting improvements, and also in implementing. Now, in some places, well, in all places, at least some of the time, the government is incapable. It may be at your local level that you just find that you have a particularly inept group of politicians in play at the moment, or in some cases the federal government is not capable. And in those cases, the Infection Control Society can play a much larger role in defining policy and pushing for it to happen. It doesn't mean to become discouraged and do less. It really means become energized, do more, get some help from people who are really capable in the area, and do more. What can you personally do? You can do the things that I mentioned before, write research reports, letters to editors, get your Infection Control Society moving on this. You can join with other organizations and form regional projects. You can push the global organizations. I mentioned that IFIC, APSIC, the Asia-Pacific Society of Infection Control, and ASEAN, the other Asian Economic Development Project, these don't have any sort of interest in or capability for neonatal and maternal mortality, and you can help them with that. You can collaborate with your obstetric, pediatric, and public health colleagues, particularly the public health colleagues. I see public health as making the bridge between the hospital and the community. Right now it seems to happen in separate silos in many, many places, but it has to happen with the organizations that actually serve the population in the place where the problems exist. So safe childbirth, we need to get it on the world agenda and keep it there. Let me mention again the IFIC Safe Childbirth Competition. You can access an application for that at www.theific.org and then click on the IFIC COVIDian grant proposal. The grant proposals will be accepted until the end of this month. It's a small grant. You know, this is not going to change a large thing. It's $3,000 U.S. But it provides the opportunity to explore the problem in your area and to set up a small project or a demonstration project to show that your hospital or your infection control society or a local or regional thing can develop something that actually has an impact. Now, this is not a grant to present an abstract at a conference. This is a grant to actually do the project. So we've got half a dozen or so project applications in. I'd like to see a lot more. I think that for me, this has been a surprising problem to have to come to grips with sort of at the end of my career. It's using muscles in my brain that haven't been exercised for some time. And it may be something that affects you that way too. So what would help me the most in this would be to have lots and lots of proposals come in, because I assume that the people who develop the proposals are local folks in a specific situation, and they're saying, I've looked at my situation, and this is the thing that we can do. It's doable. It can be done for this amount of money, and we think it's going to be helpful in the situation. So very important for me to see a lot of proposals. Now, at the beginning of the program, I mentioned one other thing that I thought would be very important, and that is if you would like to become involved in the IFIC Safe Childbirth Special Interest Group, you can contact me for that, and I'll send you back information. I'd particularly appreciate hearing from people who are able to actually contribute to the special interest group, that is, have time and are willing to volunteer at least some effort in either writing, getting projects done, contributing in some way. And that's the end of my prepared comments. Let me mention again how really helpful it is for me to have the opportunity to speak with you and bring this problem, which has been so unusual in our background, up to the top of the table where we can really get a look at it. Thank you again for participating.
Thank you very much, Pat. It's been a wonderful presentation. It's actually, for me, it's been a shocking presentation. I'm really, really shocked to hear how little attention is actually being paid to the role of infections in safe childbirth. Is that a big part of your interest group's agenda, just building awareness?
A big part of it is building awareness, Paul, and trying to get some way to share hospital problems. That is, you could see from the data that hospital infection rates for neonates in poor resource-poor settings are very high, and community people working together. In my entire experience of infection prevention in a fairly large number of hospitals, The only time I really worked with community organizations was for a look-back program after some sort of exposure, like tuberculosis or bad injection problems, something like that. So there's not a structure or a framework for hospital infection control personnel to share their experience or their expertise in the community, and there's also no existing way for that communication to happen. I think that's one of the biggest defects in the way we deliver care right now. And yes, I found it shocking too.
There's not a lot of published data on it. I'm glad you mentioned Victor Rosenthal's work. He seems to be a man who's in perpetual motion. He publishes and he does so much. I'm glad that you mentioned his work. Is he part of your special interest group?
Yes, he is part of the special interest group. And more than that, I guess about 8 or 10 months ago when I first became aware that this was a huge problem, I mean, just huge, just beyond what I could even conceptualize, I asked him if he could add hospitals, add capacity to the International Nosocomial Infection Control Consortium in the area of NICUs so that I could get more data to look at, because I couldn't understand how everything was fitting together. And he went way out of his way to add hospitals with NICUs to the consortium so that within a year or so we could get fairly decent data about occurrences and types of infection that were problems. I have found that the problem is so huge, neonatal mortality. Parents feel so angry and powerless when their babies die in the hospital of hospital infections, that one of our abstract presenters at IFIC last year was from a South American country where the government had nearly been brought down by failure to supervise hospitals. They had a huge neonatal outbreak of Klebsiella. They had a fair number of deaths, maybe 12 or 13 over a fairly short period of time. But there were hundreds of thousands of people protesting in the street. It nearly brought down the government because of their inadequate hospital care.
Thank you very much for this wonderful talk.
Oh, Paul, thank you.
Thank you to all of you for listening. You will get an email from me shortly with the information that Pat wants you to have. So to all, we'll talk again very soon. Goodbye.